All right. Well, we have people that have shown up on time. I like this crowd. Very prompt and punctual. So why don't you go ahead and start us with an introduction of why we should all be a little bit more optimistic, why that might be a more objectively realistic point of view and more in our self-interest. And I will get on to bringing a few more others into the room.
Right. So my topic today for is why, what if the world isn't ending? And I put it that way because if you listen to most political and cultural discussion from just about anybody, from any political perspective or philosophical perspective, what you typically get is that the world is ending. And if you're on the left, it's ending because of global warming. I mean, I had a middle school girl tell me in great earnestness a few years ago that we had 12 years and then the world was going to be completely wrecked. Because of global warming, and people are out promoting this idea. If you're on the right, the world's ending because of secularism or moral decay or whatever, or political correctness, wokeism, whatever. They're going to throw us all round us all up and put us into camps, the woke into woke concentration camps, and we're all going to be doomed. There's a lot of gloom and doom and emergency, and you know why this happens because. Part of it is that some of these trends are real. Some of these trends are things we should be worried about, and that if we don't oppose them, they could become things that are extremely detrimental to our lives. So it's worth opposing them early on and stopping and like wokeism or political correctness, to the extent that's a threat to free speech, it's worth nipping it in the bud and being alarmed about it earlier rather than waiting until it's too late. But it's also because these hysterias, they get people angry, they get people worked up, they create a lot of energy. It creates a huge incentive for people to stoke that sense of gloom and doom. I mean, in 20, 30 years as a writer, one of the iron rules that you have to learn as a writer is that people are like 10 times more likely to respond to something you wrote if they're angry at you than if they like you. If they like it, they're like, oh, that's nice, and they move on. But if they're angry, they will write a note. They'll mail something in, and you sort of have to adjust your expectations that, okay, if I just got a whole bunch of hate mail, it's not that everybody actually hates what I wrote. It's that the angry people were more likely to write to me. And so there's these sort of biases. But if you actually look at what's going on in the world objectively, what you see is a steady, even through a lot of turmoil, even through a lot of emergencies, there's actually what's going on is a steady improvement in human life. Now, I'm going to refer people to Steven Pinker on this because he's written a lot on it in the last few years. I sort of feel like he's a Johnny come lately because I've been writing this stuff for about 15, 20 years, making this case. But Steven Pinker has actually done an excellent job. His book Enlightenment Now, which is a book sort of in defense of Enlightenment values. Most of that book, see, I found that book to be actually, philosophically, if you're looking for a really great philosophical explanation of what the Enlightenment was and how it achieved the results, it's not very strong. But if you just want to have drilled into your head over and over again this story of human progress, I highly recommend the book. I think most people need to have that drilled into their heads. He has hundreds of pages where he goes, exhaustively over statistics on every different aspect of human life. And shows the material improvement, the improvement in wealth, the improvement in health, the improvement across all different factors. And it's distilled sometimes in a graph that one person has called the most important graph in the world. And it shows basically wealth per capita, wealth per human being on the planet Earth, a graph of that over like 2,000 years. And basically the whole graph is mostly flat until about 1800, and it suddenly goes whoosh and does this, geometric increase till it's practically vertical. And that's really the story of the last 200 years is what somebody's called the Great Escape, meaning the Great Escape from poverty. And it's accelerated and it starts out in Europe with the Industrial Revolution, but over time it's spread across the world. It's accelerated and it's spread across the world in the last few decades so that we're now at the point where, like, since in the last 20, 30 years, something like 85% of the people who were in what's classified as extreme poverty, living on something like less than a dollar a day, the number of people in extreme poverty has been cut by something like 85%. It's these enormous progress in the conquest of poverty across the world as the benefits of the Industrial Revolution have spread outward and gone across to places that they'd never reached before. But what Steven Pinker shows, and I've also looked up a lot of statistics on this, is you can see evidence of moral and intellectual progress as well. So, you know, one of the fallbacks is people will say, oh, well, sure, we have material progress. You can get a cheap big screen TV, but morally we've degraded. Well, by some measures, you know, it's hard to measure moral degradation, but by some measures, for example, one of the reasons Pinker's cited on this so much is he actually has made a detailed study on violence, on the history of violence, and argues that, you know, with the exception of, you know, we think of the crime wave of the 1970s, that's kind of a blip. The overall historical pattern is that human societies are less violent today than they used to be. The idea of this sort of, you know, this ideal, sort of Rousseauian ideal of the peaceful hunter-gatherer, the noble savage, he says, you know, the life among these peaceful hunter-gatherers was actually extremely violent. Violent death was much more common. People killing each other over food, over land, over women, whatever. That was much more common 1,000 years ago or 10,000 years ago, and we live in much less violent societies today. But also education. You know, we're talking about moral or intellectual or spiritual progress. Far more people are educated and have access to education today than have ever had in human history. People have more access, especially with the internet and everything like that, they have more access to literature, to art, to music than they have ever had in all of human history. So, you know, if people aren't taking advantage of that, that's up to them, but they have more access to it. So we can see that it's not just material progress, that with material progress also comes, by some measures, substantial moral and intellectual progress. All right, so if this is the overall story, in contradiction to what we keep hearing of everybody saying, oh, gloom and doom, the world's going to end either by global warming or, you know, moral collapse or dictatorship or what have you, there's this disconnect between our normal political debate and what's actually happening in the world. And so we have to adjust we should actually be adjusting our political debate to match that. And I have a specific thing I'm going to wrap up soon to go to, because we have more discussion. But I think it poses a specific challenge to objectivists based on the history of objectivists. But I think this comes from, you know, Atlas Shrugged tells the story. So Ayn Rand has this influence on us as objectivists, that Atlas Shrugged tells the story of, here's society collapsing, and here are the causes of the collapse, and it's indicated how we can get out of the collapse, and how we could go back to having progress, but the story is about the collapse. And I think that sort of has colored the way objectivists look at things over the years, that we still sort of think of ourselves as being, you know, in the early pages right before the story of Atlas Shrugged begins, where we're starting to slide into collapse. And through the 1970s, I totally get that somebody would have that, you know, that would seem realistic. Over a period of years, when things actually keep improving, you have to sort of re-question. And I think one specific thing that happened, this first struck me, and this is why I said I've been on the Progress Brigade for a while. It first struck me about, I think it was 2003, and I was editing The Intellectual Activist, and we were coming up on the 25th anniversary. So I sort of did a review of, you know, here's all the things that were written in The Intellectual Activist. Here are all the things that were covered over the years, over 25 years. And a pattern I noticed is that the implicit theme of the news coverage in The Intellectual Activist, and especially in the Peter Schwartz years, was the implicit theme was, here's how the world is going to hell because people haven't accepted objectivist ideas. So it's like, here are all the things that are going wrong because people have the wrong ideas. And, you know, early on, you could see, you know, this began publishing in 1978. You know, there's inflation, there's the energy crisis, there's, you know, the Iran hostage crisis, there's the Soviet Union on the march. There were lots of things that were going wrong, and you could have a lot to discuss if you wanted to talk about the world going downhill. But the pattern I noticed is that as soon as something stopped being a problem, it stopped being discussed. So there was never an article, follow-up article later on saying, well, okay, now that we don't have inflation anymore, how did we do that? How did we get rid of inflation? There was relatively little discussion among objectivists about, the fall of the Berlin Wall, the Soviet Union overnight practically ups and disappears without a shot being fired, or at least not a shot directly between us and them. And there was relatively little discussion about how did this happen? Why did this happen? So I think objectivism has mired into the same and needs to adjust itself in the same way that it's not just about, oh, here's what's horrible in the world. You also have to be able to explain what went right. So I wrote a series of articles called What Went Right, sort of addressing this. And the overall thing I want to say about how this would affect our view of the world and the way we advocate things is I think we need to move less from that perspective of here's how things are going wrong because people have the bad ideas and focus more on, I think we have a far more interesting and enlightening and much more friendly debates in the culture if it were a battle over who gets to claim credit for all the things that are going right. If we go point and say, well, look, extreme poverty has been conquered, and we could say, well, that's because of capitalism and that's because of science and technology and reason. And as objectivists, there's all sorts of things we can bring to that discussion to say, here's how the adoption of these enlightenment ideas, which we stand for and are able to defend, the adoption of those ideas has led to all these beneficial results. So I think that would really kind of upend and very much change the way we look at the world and the way that we debate things if we sort of grasp and recognize the extent to which human progress has occurred and is still occurring.
That's great. Well, this has also been a theme of ours at the Atlas Society for a long time. We've interviewed Marion Tupi. He is, of course, the author of 10 Trends Every Smart Person Should Know. And Johan Norberg.
Great website, humanprogress.org.
Human Progress, yep.
Yeah.
And
if you really want to convince yourself the world is going better, they're full of charts and graphs. And I love a good chart and graph. All full of this data, basically comprehensively demonstrating this.
Yes. Marion Tupi we've had on the show. Marion Tupi, Johan Norberg, and John Tierney, who wrote The Power of Bad. He talked about just our wiring, how evolutionarily we've been optimized to perceive threats and focus on them. And I guess the flip side of that is our theme of gratitude. Draw My Life video, My Name is Gratitude, and Professor Kelly's work on why gratitude is in our selfish best interest. So I wanted to also remind everyone, first of all, welcome. Thanks for joining us. We are going to record this, so we do make these chats available on our podcast platform. So if you ever miss one or you want to go back and check something out, you'll find them there. And I wanted to recognize Professor Jason Hill, one of our senior scholars. I'm just going to give him an invite in case he has something to add to the conversation. And Aaron Tao also is here. He runs our book club, and I think they had a great book club last night on Stephen Koonin's book, Unsettled. So please raise your hand, folks, if you have a question or a comment. You are welcome. Jason.
Hi. Hi, Jennifer. Hi, Rob. This is very, very interesting. Because I tend to be, apart from the statistics and the data that's out there, I tend to be an optimist by nature, a hopeless optimist, and believe in the idea of moral progress against the backdrop of all the evidence. But there are a couple of comments I wanted to make. One is, a kind of question or a kind of observation, aside from sort of hysterical children and apocalyptic adults who sort of posit the end of the world, it seems to me that what arises in my mind is not whether the world will end, but whether a type of world will end that is consonant with man's nature as a rational creature. That is, will the milieu that is consonant with his nature as a rational being, that is the Constitutional Republic of the United States, which was the first unprecedented phenomenon that had a one-to-one epistemological matchup between the conditions that are required for man's survival and tapping directly into man's nature as a both a biological and a political creature, came together for the first time in history. So, and I think that's a very real, so I don't think the world is going to end. And I think short of, you know, hysterical children and apocalyptic adults. But for me, the more pressing question, Rob, is as a professor of 25 years in the classroom, you know, now I see where the type of world that is conducive to flourishing, to thriving against the backdrop of all this progress, because you're right. People are getting an education. More people are getting an education. But what type of education are they getting? It's a completely nefarious kind that they're getting in the universes today. So capitalism, reason, logic, objective reality, all the phenomena that promote the milieu in which we need to matriculate as rational creatures are being undercut. So my question very briefly for you is, if we sort of think of the a type of world that will end, and we look at the forces, the powerful forces that are at work in the world today to obliterate the progress that you outlined, which I completely agree with exists, eradication of poverty, longevity of life, et cetera, not to say nothing of hygiene, are those forces... are those forces strong enough to overpower or to undermine a particular type of world that is conducive to our nature so that we'll not just survive, but that we will continue to flourish and thrive within the midst of this moral progress that you've so eloquently outlined?
So the way I would take the question, maybe I could rephrase it, I think you get the essence of it, is, we've achieved this tremendous progress, but what if we're about to basically throw it all away? What if by not appreciating it and by opposing all the things that created that progress, we're actually going to undercut it and destroy it? I mean, basically, are we in the last years of the Roman Empire? Because they actually did that. You know, they had a highly advanced classical world, incredible achievements in art and technology and law and that sort of thing. And then they went ahead and they deliberately, quite deliberately, threw it all away and destroyed the classical civilization. I think that is the danger. But I also want to caution against sort of, I call it cultural Malthusianism. Right. So Thomas Malthus is the one. So a lot of these doomsday claims made by the environmentalists come from the calculations made by Reverend Thomas Malthus, a scientist and intellectual in the late 18th century, who basically said the basic calculation he made was that the problems and needs of human life are going to expand faster than our ability to provide for them. And specifically, it was about food. You know, the population was going to expand faster than our ability to grow food to feed people, and so we were going to starve. And of course, this turned out to be famously and completely wrong. Even though the idea persists, you know, in environmentalists today, it turned out to be spectacularly wrong, because what happened is we had economic and technological progress, and what happened is that our ability to solve problems advanced far. You know, he was writing right before the Industrial Revolution. What he didn't realize is our ability to solve problems was going to expand far faster than our ability than the population pressures that would create problems, and I think that the cultural Malthusianism is the idea that we have all these threats culturally and intellectually that we're not going to be able to rally, that, you know, somehow we're going to get this dwindling number of people trying to rally to address these cultural and intellectual threats to progress. And I have a little more confidence that actually as these problems pop up, we will rally and people will come up with new ideas, or they will at least come up with defenses of the old ideas, and they'll be asking questions, and there's the possibility of us being able to, you know, answer these woke, you know, the political correctness or wokeness of today's universities will be able to answer these things intellectually and culturally and come up with alternatives to them. I'm seeing some signs that we might be sort of turning the tide on wokeness. I'm sure it'll take a long time for it to reach back to where you are, Jason, in the universities. In the wider culture, I think it's starting to be beaten back. But I think that is the sort of the question of the age. But I think it comes from the fact that, again, the radicalism of political correctness, of Marxism, of the left, and also of the liberal right, a lot of the radicalism of these anti-Enlightenment ideas, these ideas that are going to turn back the tide of progress, a lot of that comes from the idea that they convince people the world's a horrible place. America is shot through with systemic racism. The working class is being milked blood dry by the evil capitalists. The world's about to end because of global warming. They create this apocalyptic view of the world because it's what justifies the idea of saying everything there is in civil society we have right now, it all has to be burned down, burned to the ground, it has to be thrown out. We have to completely get rid of it in favor of a radically different system. So in a way, arguing for progress is part of the way that we help turn the tide against the intellectual forces that are trying to stop progress. Because we show that, no, actually, if you create this radical system where you burn everything to the ground, you're actually going to be hugely destructive to a society that's actually quite good. I think one of the implications of if we recognize progress is you would have, even as radical as I am, as a radical pro-capitalist, it would imply a more incrementalist approach to change and reform. More of a sense of, well, actually, if things are pretty good, you don't go radically change the entire basis of society. You go and you find one thing at a time and say, well, let's change this and let's improve that and let's question this assumption over there. And it involves a much less radical and more incremental and more civil and less revolutionary attitude towards how you discuss and debate political and cultural issues.
Roger, welcome back.
Thanks, Jennifer. Hey, Rob, again. Thanks again for joining. I've got a question. So you mentioned Atlas Shrugged and, that wonderful thought experiment. What if we took the best and brightest and went to a valley in Colorado? What would happen? Of course, it would burn down. I oftentimes consider myself a Galtian because I actually think that's the right move, generally. And I try to organize my sort of thinking and business around that. But I get the sense that objectivists, and some of what you said right there, might resist that move or that strategy to deal with the world as it is. So I'm wondering if you could just comment on what might be the difference between how Ayn Rand presents that sort of thought experiment solution as a way to address the issues of the world versus what, an objectivist, like yourself might say today. That is, if somebody came up and said, hey, let's do that.
Yeah.
What would be your response?
Well, I sort of feel about that the way I do about the gold bugs. Now, the part of the history here is in the early 90s, I worked for briefly worked in the financial media. And so I know that forever, for a long time, there have been the guys back there saying, oh, everybody should be invested. I guess the modern equivalent would be the Bitcoin people, right? But it's like everybody should be invested in gold because the world's currencies are going to collapse. And, these are people who consistently basically said that the economy is the whole world currency system is on the verge of collapse. And they've been saying this, consistently for 50, 60 years. And it's one of those cases where, the old joke is that they predicted 7 of the last 2 recessions. So they're constantly, if you're constantly predicting gloom and doom, you can always claim, every time there's a market downturn, you can always claim to be proven right. But, if you actually did that and if you actually acted on that gloom and doom approach and as directing your investment portfolio, you would have missed enormous gains made, consistently over the years by the stock market and that sort of thing. So it's if you're too much, I think that's my attitude towards if, you read Atlas Shrugged in 1958 and you hold yourself off up in a valley in Colorado with your existing technology and wealth of 1958, even if you would manage to survive with a small group of people, unless they were all super geniuses who were going to advance even faster, you probably would have missed out on this enormous global economic growth and technological progress of the last, 63 years, something like that. So that's sort of the practical answer. Now, the other part of the answer, is, you know, it was a literary thought experiment, right? It was, she created a series of conditions in her fictional world that would make Galt's strike be the correct and only answer. But those conditions are different than the conditions we have. And it's kind of subtle because she doesn't, you know, she doesn't show you what happens before page one. It's sort of hinted at, and I think specifically, I wrote about this in my book on Atlas Shrugged, that she doesn't really show you a lot of the political background. So clearly, if you read it carefully, you can see that it's implicitly that political and intellectual freedom has disappeared somehow in the years before Atlas Shrugged begins. So, you know, in all the debates that are happening, you know, so Dagny Taggart is never invited to come on to CNN or Fox to give her position on what we should do about the railroads, right? The good guys are basically without any voice at all in the media, and this has somehow happened. And she doesn't focus on that. She doesn't really show you how it happened or give the specifics of it, because that's not her theme in this, in the story. That would be a distraction from her theme. But she does indicate, you know, imply throughout the book, she has little subtle implications, and they become less subtle as the book goes on, and we get to the later stages where the dictatorship's really showing its teeth. But there are these implications that that debate has, that political and intellectual debate has been shut down and is not occurring. And that's the case. I think that's the point we'd have to get to before you said, okay, you know, we go to a valley in Colorado, or we all move to Singapore, or we, you know, seastead off of South America, or whatever the plan is for withdrawing. So that's the other part. But the last part, and this is the radical one, I think, that I think objectivists need to rethink. And I got into a lot of trouble over this theory about 15 years ago. And that is, I think, that the objectivist theory about how ideas move history has been excessively top-down. And what I mean by that is it tends to be, you know, the idea that ideas move history and philosophical ideas have an effect on and determine the course of civilization tended to come to be boiled down to mean the ideas being taught in philosophy classes at universities are the one single determinant that then filters, like I said, from the top down. It goes from the top down and totally dominates every other field. And I propose more, I think we need to have a more of a bottom-up or reciprocal view that the advance of civilization in all these other different ways, the advance of trade and of capitalism, global capitalism, scientific and technological education, produces this tremendous reserve of implicit good philosophical ideas. Now, what I mean by implicit is, if you get a scientific and technological education, you are basically being taught the rules of rational thinking. You're being taught the way, how to think and a regard for thinking rationally. And that is being propagated out in a way that helps counteract. And I think that explains some of how, you know, Jason can be absolutely right that if you're, you know, dealing with students who are in the universities, especially the elite universities, and looking at the explicit philosophical ideas that are being taught, you'd think we're all going to collapse tomorrow. But then you have to realize there's something must, basically it's me going through that experience 30 years ago in college, and then seeing that we didn't collapse, and sort of asking, well, something must be beating that back. Something must be moving us in the other direction. And I think a lot of it is the spread of implicit good ideas, specifically regard for reason by way of science and technology, a regard for individualism by way of commerce and trade and the way people actually live their lives. And also, you know, you could see good ideas that had spread in economics. One of the big, I think, stories of intellectual progress that we tend not to think about very much, but I think is underestimated, is what's happened in the field of psychology, where from what I can tell, the old Freudian theory of psychoanalysis has faded in favor of what's called cognitive behavioral therapy, which is basically exactly Ayn Rand's view of the emotions, that the emotions are the results of thinking. And that is becoming, from what I can tell, is becoming the dominant new field of psychology. So there's all this progress happening in other fields that is sort of counteracting the continued collapse of, or the ongoing collapse of explicit philosophy. And I think we have to adjust ourselves from this sort of purely top-down model of how ideas affect the world and realize that it's actually, you know, ideas are coming from all different directions, from the bottom up, from the sciences, from the from other intellectual fields, and that it's not just the stuff being injected in the philosophy classes. Because if that were what determined the course of the world, I think we wouldn't have made it this far.
Can I just say, for the Galt move to work, the only way to make it work is if you can get all the best people to go to Colorado with you. It doesn't work if you just go on your own a couple of your buddies. And so I've always thought that is the test. If you can get them to go, then the world is that way. If you can't get them to go, then the world isn't that way. Maybe it is doing all right.
Well, also the in my book on Atlas Shrugged, I did something where I took I compared Galt's strategy in his strike. I compared it to Vaclav Havel's essay, "The Power of the Powerless," and his recommendation. Basically, it set the blueprint for the whole dissident movement for the last 10 years of Soviet rule. And I thought this fascinating, the parallels there. It's like he had come up with many of the same ideas as Ayn Rand on a totally parallel track. And he sort of did, it's his version of Galt's Gulch that I think is interesting and maybe a model for, a much more realistic model for us in the societies where we live, because his version of Galt's Gulch wasn't, oh, we're all going to find a valley somewhere in Czechoslovakia and you know, some up in the hills in Bohemia, we'll find a valley and we'll be secretly away from the secret police. It was more that you build a parallel society. That is, you have artists and intellectuals and people doing whatever they can to work outside the confines of the propaganda system